Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Colin Delaney. This week,
we chat to Zenith Optimedia's fairly new boss, Ian Perrin.
Ten's new sales boss departs.
More shenanigans at Fairfax.
Marketing Australia's films. Answering the unanswerable.
Advertising ad agencies.
And Lara Bingle on the set.
With us today at the studios of CBS Interactive is Ian Perrin, CEO for Australia and New Zealand Zenith Optimedia. Hey, Ian.
Hello, Tim. How are you going?
And Mumbrella's Cathy McGinn.
Hello.
Let's make a start with Zeddo, Ian. I always make the mistake when everyone comes in, I always say they're new, and then it turns out actually it feels new, but they've been there for 6 months. How are things, and how long have you actually been in the desk now?
Well, funnily enough, it has been 6 months, so you're about spot on. Things are going really well. We had a sort of slow start in terms of me starting off trying to work out what we needed to do. Since then, we've been on quite a exciting journey in terms of repositioning the agency around the open agency.
Because I guess that's the thing, when you first come in, I guess the thing is, do you rush around and do everything at once, or do you spend your first sort of 100 days working out what's happening? What did you do to begin with?
I think it's very easy to try and fix everything in the first 3 months, but I think you need to take a step back and evaluate all of the different aspects of the business and then start to make some decisions on which ones you need to prioritise. And we sort of went through that process, and the most important thing to prioritise for me was the positioning and the marketing and the leadership of the business. So that's really where we focused on first.
That was the open agency.
And that was the open agency. And we've made quite a few changes around being the open agency in terms of the people that we've brought in terms of the product that we're delivering, and also in terms of the processes within the agency. So that's still at an early stage, but we're quite excited with the progress we've made in a short period of time.
I was going to ask, actually, how much of that open agency position is aspirational still, and how much truly describes the agency as it is at the moment?
Well, I think when you come up with an agency positioning, you really want it to be aspirational, you want it to be ambitious, and you want it to be something that's going to be around for a number of years. And so we're really in stage one of the open agency. We've got an awful long way to go. There are various things that we feel like we've put in place, but there's an awful lot more we still need to do to make us truly an open agency.
So you recently retained the Qantas account. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How important was that to the agency?
It was a massive statement, I think, not only to our own people, to make themselves believe in Zenith Optimedia again and believe in the new product and the new positioning that we've started to put in the market. So it was critical for our own staff. But also I think it made a statement to the market that Zenith Optimedia is back. We've certainly been quiet for a number of years. And I think there's a lot of people, a lot of texts, a lot of emails from people saying, wow, it's good to have Zenith Optimedia competitive again. And I think it certainly showed us in that light.
Ian, should an agency feel jilted when a client calls a pitch?
No, I don't think so. I think in this day and age, it's part of due diligence that a lot of companies feel that they need to go through. And I think it's only fair that they have a look at their different agencies and look what's out in the marketplace. They might be happy with what they're getting, but they don't know what the competitive set is. So I don't think they should be jilted at all. I think it's an opportunity for an agency to rejuvenate itself, to relook at what they're delivering for that client, and see new ways of working that will probably benefit everyone.
And the feedback that we had from the market, I remember we had Toby Jenner in at some stage during the pitch, who said that it was a very well-run pitch as well, just in terms of the levels of briefing there were for the agencies. Now, obviously towards the end there were a few twists and turns as Qantas went through its own issues. But was that the experience for you, that it was a well-run pitch?
It absolutely was, and I think through the whole process we probably felt that way, and if we hadn't been successful at the end, we probably would still say the same thing, that it was probably one of the most comprehensive pitches that I've certainly been involved in, and I think it just shows the dedication that Qantas have towards rebuilding their brand, making it better, making it a more exciting, innovative, modern brand, and the fact that they went through such diligence in the pitch process really shows how committed Qantas are to marketing and how committed they are to making their brand a whole heap better.
And which are the other big clients which are kind of keeping you busy at the moment? Who's kind of most active at the moment?
Well, we've got a number of blue chip pieces of business, and so we kind of spread our time fairly equitably across those businesses. So Nestle, News, NAB, Honda, to name a few. But we've certainly got a nice broad spectrum of blue chip clients that, you know, keep us busy on a day-to-day basis.
And which of those are kind of gearing up for the Olympics at the moment?
Well, obviously Qantas is going to be very involved in the Olympics. And Foxtel, which is part of News, have some rights for the Olympics as well. So those are the two brands that, you know, will really be focused in that area.
And with not much time to go now until the Games, presumably most of the stuff is already in place and has been for ages.
Yes, it has, yeah. I mean, you know, normal marketing cycles are certainly, you know, quite a few months out. So most of the plans have been put in place for those things. Obviously, you need to be aware of competitive threats from guerrilla marketers and different people doing different things close to the time. So you need to stay very much on top of your activity. But most of the work we've been doing for the Olympics is locked.
Now, has anything to move globally? I was working back in London when it rebranded as the ROI Agency. Which at the time really, you know, it set an agenda. It really did get people sort of certainly within the industry talking about what ROI meant and was this the single most important thing to client. Now, that is still the global positioning. Now, how do you sort of nuance it between being the open agency and the ROI agency?
Well, I don't think there's too much nuance in my mind. I think the ambition for the business is to be the ROI agency. And we've also worked globally on becoming the live ROI agency. So really evolving the statement to not be a static conversation about ROI, but showing that the evolution of how you deliver ROI is now a lot more live. So that's very much the ambition of the business. How we articulate that at a local level in terms of delivering live ROI is by being an open agency. So everything we've created from the agency is to be more open in order to deliver live ROI. So open becomes the why, ROI, live ROI is pretty much the what.
Now, I guess one of the reasons why it was particularly interesting that you guys went for open was because certainly before your time, you were seen as probably the least open agency. I think the focus was on working for clients rather than building an industry profile. We published last week the Umbrella Media Agency Review, which is a measure, obviously, of industry perceptions, and you guys did pretty badly, second from bottom. Do you think that was a perceptions issue?
Absolutely. I think, you know, just to answer the first question first, we didn't launch open because we'd been more closed. I think open is a statement around what I perceive the market to be very closed. I think not only ourselves, but I think other media agencies in the past have been very closed in terms of how they operate, not just from a perception point of view, but in terms of the product that they deliver and the sorts of solutions they deliver. The processes most definitely are very closed. They like to own things like channel planning and data and relationships with the media companies. And I think that makes them very closed. The statement we're making around open is to be different to those agencies. And so it isn't a reflection on where Zenith Optimedia has been, but a reflection on a competitive market. In terms of the perception report, I think I'll be the first to admit that the marketing of Zenith Optimedia hasn't been great for a number of years, and it's important that we start to promote the business a whole heap better. Whether we're second last in the industry is probably open for debate. It certainly hurt reading that. Whether I feel it's accurate or not is probably not the point. I think the bigger point is we need to be better at promoting our business, and so we'll take that on the chin and make sure we hopefully improve by next year.
Next, 10 Sales Boss Departs.
This week saw the dramatic departure of Mike Morrison, 10's sales boss. Effective immediately, Morrison's exit comes less than 6 months after entering the role and one of the first major hires by CEO James Warburton. Tim, what do you make of this?
Yeah, and I'll be interested to get Ian's sense of this as well. Firstly, it did come as a surprise, as did his appointment in the first place. Now, Mike Morrison came very much from a strategy role, so, you know, a long time within the Y&R group, George Patterson, GP Y&R, kind of always in strategy roles, always seen within the industry as being a good strategic thinker, obviously, in that role, but also a really good presenter and salesman. I suspect that what James Warburton wanted to do when he brought him in was put this kind of long-term strategic plan in. But then we've seen the market go very short. 10 didn't hit its numbers, did pretty badly last time around. The market didn't like them. They've since done a revenue raising from their owners, all of which gives me the sense that what they've decided they need is a more traditional do the deals, get the dollars in the next quarter type salesperson for now. My guess is they're mainly looking in this market. I don't think it will necessarily be an internal promotion. It wasn't last time around. I presume there are people they're already talking to. My read of it is he did jump, probably did work out, it wasn't working out. But that's not to say that he could have happily been comfortably stayed if he hadn't chosen to jump. Don't know, and you're probably as close to this one as anyone else.
Yeah, I think you're pretty much spot on, Tim. I think it was a very bold, innovative move by James when he first came in to appoint Mike. And I think, you know, rather than looking at the negatives, I think we should applaud the fact that he was trying to look for somebody outside of the TV industry. And I think that was, you know, it was as you say, you know, Mike's got great strategic skills and he is a great orator and presenter. So I think it was a bold, smart move. It's a slightly unfortunate that it hasn't worked out, but I don't think we should see that as an overly negative thing. I think, you know, he's tried something, it hasn't worked. It's time to try something different. And, you know, if they've worked it out between them that it hasn't worked out, then good for them for making a fast decision and moving on. So I think it'll be interesting to see where James goes next in appointing somebody new, because as you say, do you go back to a more traditional TV person, or do you look for somebody similar again to Mike, who's going to push things forward?
If you were him, what would you do? And in the realities of this market as well, you know, just the fact that it's a really short market for TV.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult market for television at the moment. As you say, it is very short. So if I was James, I'd look for somebody with more strategic, longer-term skills, because I think so many people who have been in the industry for a long period of time can play the short-term game very effectively. But I think the short-term game is not going to get Channel 10 out of the problems that it currently is in. You know, James will need some really smart people around him in order to build the network over the next 3 years to something that is, you know, on a par with the other two networks. And, we're seeing some great progress from Channel 9, and they're doing a phenomenal job. But it took them a little bit of time to get that right, and it'll take James time to get it right. So he needs to get the right people in place and build those building blocks in order to make it a great network in 2013.
And TV trading is one of those things, it feels to me like you can't just bring someone in from another part of the industry that easily. They don't automatically make it. You know, there are some dark arts involved.
I think historically that's been the case. I think the television industry, or what we call the television industry, is changing dramatically, you know, in front of our very eyes. You know, everyone talks about content at the moment. If you think about YouTube being perhaps the I think it's the fifth largest TV network in Australia. So that's changing incredibly quickly. So, you know, that's why I'd probably err towards the side of getting somebody new and different in, as opposed to getting a traditional TV person.
Next, Fairfax's continued shenanigans.
On Tuesday, Fairfax told the market it expected profits to be down about 17% this year. It also confirmed it would move regional production roles from Australia to New Zealand as suspected. Tim, what do you make of this week's developments?
Yeah, as you say, some of it expected. So they had extended talks with the staff, which were kind of brokered by the union, on whether there was an alternative plan that wouldn't see a lot of these kind of backroom production jobs. So, you know, the guys who handle the copy after it's been written by the reporters. The union believed it helped staff put forward an alternative which would still save on job numbers but at least keep the jobs local and within Australia. The debate still being about, is it better to have your sub-editors who've got local knowledge? At the same time, though, Fairfax also issued an update to the market, which there were a few things. So profits down, they're saying for the first half of this calendar year, so second half of the financial year, profits down about 8%, which last time they updated the market was saying the profit, revenues down 8%, profits down probably about 100 million for the year. So you know, that's a significant dip. But oddly, the market, the shares haven't moved that much as a result of this. They have been falling for the last few weeks, you know, to sort of almost record lows. But you almost get the sense that it wasn't as bad as the market feared when, you know, when they actually made the announcement. You know, they were sort of, there's some debt to repay, and they're saying, okay, that's fine, they're going to be able to repay the debt on time. I think people were scared it was going to be bigger than 8% revenue fall. Yeah, it still feels like a troubled company, you know, because of the business it's in. Still struggling to work out how to just make that leap from print to digital. And we've speculated plenty in recent weeks about, you know, when they'll no longer be printing newspapers and be all digital. You know, just this week on Thursday, they unveiled the next version of the apps for the Sydney Morning Herald and for the Age, which are they're based on the same platform which the AFR app was launched a few weeks ago, and that was very strong. So I suspect those apps will be a step forward as well. So there's a lot going on with Fairfax, and it's you know, it's not out of the woods, but I guess arguably it's not for want of trying.
And does outsourcing production actually make any difference to advertisers? Would it affect your clients' likelihood to advertise?
I don't think it'll make a huge difference for advertisers. I think as long as the quality of the product remains the same and we see no diminishing value in terms of what they're providing, I don't think it'll make a huge difference to us as advertisers, no.
And what do you think of the... Again, I've asked you, what would you do if you... probably the two worst jobs in media at the moment. What would you do if you're James Warburton? And what would you do if you were Greg Howard running Fairfax? If you inherited this, you know, this pool of... You know, you've got major newspaper mastheads in The Age and The Herald. You've got great radio stations like 2UE and 3AW. Some digital assets as well. How would you take the company on its transition? Because that's obviously what it's going through.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a very difficult time for them at the moment, and they're trying to best manage through a very difficult environment. And obviously they're making some decisions that are popular and some decisions that aren't so popular, but they need to do what they need to do in order to move the business forward. You know, I think people like to be somewhat dire about their predictions for the newspaper industry or the news industry. You know, I think it's going through a change of distribution as opposed to a change in business. So, you know, they've got some great assets with which to leverage some of the content that they're delivering. You mentioned, you know, the iPads and what they're doing on those. You mentioned the radio stations and how they're using those. You know, the actual printed form of newspaper, I think, will continue to diminish. But I think there are better ways and probably more cost-efficient ways with which to distribute news and opinion. And I think in the long run, we'll see some real benefits from that, both from a consumer point of view and an advertiser point of view, because it helps us to target more specific people. So I think we're in a really difficult time of change for them at the moment, but I think there's an opportunity for newspaper businesses to really change their model and provide some real value to us as advertisers.
How long do you think newspapers have got?
It depends what you classify as newspaper. If you say newspapers, I'd say they're going to carry on going as for as long as we
as a printed form.
I think you know, I think they'll become smaller and smaller, but I don't think they'll actually ever fall away. I think, you know, I live in Manly and come in on the ferry, and there's still an awful lot of people who like the printed form, like the tactile nature of it. They like doing the Sudoku, where you can actually write the Sudoku on the page, and obviously that'll change as younger people you know, get used to iPads. But I think the printed form will always stay. It'll just become a lot smaller and a lot more targeted.
See, I'm luxuriating each day. Now, the Herald comes to my front door and, you know, I read it over breakfast. And you have to excuse the various drilling noises going on outside of the studio as well. And every day I kind of feel slightly sad because I very much enjoy the newspaper experience. But I don't think it's going to be there in 2 years.
I think it'll definitely be there in 2 years. It's just a matter of how long it will be there for. I too love newspapers, always have. And I think, you know, there's something relaxing about lying back on a Saturday morning and reading a newspaper on the couch as opposed to playing with my iPad. But they're two very different experiences, and I personally will carry on doing both.
Ian, how far behind or in front is News? When will News Limited see their print wrap up and move to digital?
Well, I think News are in probably a stronger position, and they're a more diversified company. They've been very smart in terms of how they've evolved their digital model to be a paid-for model. So obviously there's a way of ensuring their revenue stays consistent even when they're moving towards a more digital format. So I think, you know, they're probably in a stronger place. I think their newspapers are continuing to do very well. I think it's quite difficult to say, you know, what is the length of newspapers. I think the more interesting question is how to evolve newspapers into the digital form. And so we'll probably be having a conversation in 2-3 years' time talking about, you know, the best ways of using newspaper content from an advertising point of view, as opposed to the decline of the tactile printed form.
Tim, journalistically, do you think that News and SMH are doing a similar job? You know, if depending on half the readership is split sort of down the Daily Telegraph and Australian side, and half is Sydney Morning Herald. What is it that people aren't picking up the SMH for as much?
God, that's quite a wide question, really, isn't it?
Refine it as you will.
Yeah. Look, I think what maybe where we're seeing differences in emphasis at the moment is how much emphasis is put on print first versus digital first. And generally what you'll I saw an example this week in the Herald where a piece of copy included the phrase announced today, and that was in the printed version. And clearly what had happened was they posted it on the website first, then later put it in the paper and hadn't even subbed out the fact that now it was yesterday. So that sort of suggests that little hints like that are where it feels like they're moving to, you know, to digital first. I get the sense that certainly with the flagships, with the Telegraph, with the Australian, the journalism is still first and foremost around the daily product. Yes, there'll be updates on the websites, but it's about what's going to be in tomorrow's paper is still the thing which consumes the journalists, consumes the editors. You know, that's the single most important thing. Whether that's the right or wrong strategy, I don't know. You know, it's probably too early to say yet. You know, you've got two different strategies. In the Herald, you've got a masthead strategy. It's all around get the reader into, for instance, the Sydney Morning Herald or Melbourne The Age, whether print, whether online. Whereas News, you've got this sort of smorgasbord. You've got, you know, your sort of your upmarket is the Australian. And pretty much the experience for the reader is the same, whether it's in print or online. You know, it's the same. The tone is the same. Your mid-market are the tabloids, whether it's the Telegraph or the Courier Mail or the Herald Sun, wherever you are in the country. And then at the populist traffic grabbing side, there's news.com.au, you know, which is unashamedly, you know, link bait. So it's two different approaches, and I don't think we actually know which one is the right one yet.
Next, Australian Noir.
Over the weekend, up against the $6 million grossing 3D behemoth of Prometheus, an Australian film opened quietly at the box office. Despite decent reviews, Swerve has tanked. Colin, why?
You're setting me up.
I say decent reviews, I think you were the one who gave it a decent review.
I liked it.
Okay, I haven't seen it.
Former podcast guest Sam Mack also liked
it. Yes, it was talked up when you and Sam talked about it on a previous podcast.
Yeah,
remind us of the film and also what Australian noir is.
So, I mean, Australian noir is a term that they're kind of using, which I quite like. But it feels like if, American novelist Elmore Leonard was to set a story in Australia in an outback town, it's very much that. It's sort of fun, pop culture, you know, pulp fiction, basically, not the film, but the genre. And, you know, there's double crosses, there's a suitcase, there's a hot girl. It's just what I would have thought good Australian sort of action thriller.
So to succeed, presumably you need distribution.
Yes, you need distribution. This film, unfortunately, only went out on 16 screens, as opposed to Prometheus, which went out on around 500 or 600 screens. Swerve took 24,000 $487.
Okay, so do you want to do the maths on what that means then?
Well, so across the 16 screens, it meant it had a screen average of $1,530.
That's per screen, so that's not per showing. That's per screen it was showing over the 4 days.
Correct, yes. If you were to divide 24,000 by 16 screens, you get the 1,500.
Okay, so it would have played at least four times then on each screen, presumably, over the 4 days.
That's being generous because,
sometimes,
you know,
it might play eight times.
Might play eight, might play two, but, you know, it means it's going out to, because it's a small distributor, it's going out to a small indie theatres rather than your Hoyts and your
Village Road. But, yeah, let's go on four then.
Okay.
And tickets at $20 a film.
Sure.
Which means how many people are in each screening?
Calculations came out, Tim, you made me do this. Calculations came out to 19 people sitting in a cinema at any one time.
But why? Why won't people watch? What, you know, the thought never occurred to me to go and see it, despite the fact you talked about it. Yet I went to Prometheus and enjoyed it.
No spoilers, thank you.
No spoilers.
Swerve doesn't need 3D, man. It's good enough as it is.
Yeah. But why didn't make it? Something about Australian film marketing, obviously.
Yeah, and it's that big question that, you know, whenever I get to speak to a director or a distributor, I ask this question and I get the feeling they're squirming and I don't think they can quite answer it. And I think, you know, frustratingly, I'll say to a distributor, send me that trailer once it hits YouTube or, you know, let us upload it or whatever. And I never get that email. I'm never a channel, or Encore is never a channel to sort of push it, whether it's tweeting it or, you know.
So that's where they're going wrong.
They're not sending it to
me.
They're
not sending you the link to their YouTube trailer.
I'd be interested to know.
Issue solved.
Ian, do you have an alternative?
If I may finish, you know, Red Dog ran ads on TV and it brought in 21 million. Swerve hasn't run ads. It's costly to run TV ads, obviously.
But surely it's more costly to the film when it fails to return.
This is what I think about. And so surely there should be some more digital strategy, to be seeding these trailers out to the correct
Ian
streams.
What do you think? What, you know, say, you know, a filmmaker or a film producer comes to you, they've got this property that they want you to suggest a strategy. What would you suggest?
Well, given we're the agency who are promoting Prometheus,
goodness, I thought for one horrible moment you were going to say Swerve.
If you want to work out the numbers on Prometheus on air, that would be fantastic because it would make us look good. So thanks for that.
It was $14,000 per screen.
There you go. Thank you.
Nice. Quick maths.
So I think, you know, for smaller brands, as always, it's very difficult to get distribution, and that's whether you're in movies or even smaller brands to try and get some shelf space on Coles. And so they need to do things differently. They need to do things in a unique way that'll get the likes of Tim away from Hoyts and into the smaller cinemas. And they're not going to do that without doing any marketing, and you're probably right. They don't have enough money to run TV ads. They don't have enough money to put budgets into huge marketing efforts, so they need to start thinking a lot more in smaller ways, in more, what I call reductive planning, which is thinking in a very specific channel in order to promote something. And you're probably right, doing things digitally, doing them virally, tapping into great people such as yourselves to promote that content or others will probably be the right thing to do.
Next, an ad agency advertising itself.
This week, an ad agency decided to advertise themselves. Melbourne-based Sphere has launched a campaign to promote itself to clients. The agency has used online video, e-direct marketing, and a microsite to push its credentials. Earlier, I caught up with Mumbrella's managing editor, Robin Hicks, to discuss it. Robin, did you like the ad? And can you explain the ad? Does it work? It doesn't quite work from just an audio format.
Yeah, well, the ad basically shows a bunch of musicians getting together and trying to record a track, but they're out of sync. And it's basically a metaphor for an integrated agency. Sphere Agency offers everything under the same roof. So research, media, planning, buying, etc. Under the one roof. And that's the idea behind the ad.
And the old adage that
an agency's work should speak for itself. Does that come into play, or is the current market so cluttered that's too simple a theory to work?
Yeah, I think you're right. An agency's work should speak for itself, but the Sphere Agency, it's been going for 10 years now, and 1 year ago it lost its biggest client, Nando's, for which it did some really good work. Now, since then, Sphere Agency has, not lost its way, but it wants to make its mark on the market again. It wants to remind people what it's good at. That's why they made the ad.
And they're promoting themselves as a one-stop shop, covering sort of all bases. Is hotshop too strong a word? And do you think this is a good angle for them to go on?
Yeah, well, I guess they've got 20 people. They're a mid-sized agency. And as I said, yeah, they do everything under the one roof, not just creative, but also media. But the sort of clients they're going for are mid-sized advertisers that spend between $2 and $10 million. I think it's the ad itself is quite a neatly packaged selling point for the ad for the agency and what it can offer clients.
And does it come under the idea of a jack of all trades, master of none? Do you think this is a good way for them to angle themselves?
Yeah, I see what you mean. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes in the market it pays to be a specialist. They've gone out there and said, we're generous, we do everything. But you know what? The ad only cost them a couple of grand. They need to get out there and remind our clients who they are, and make a bit of a name for themselves. So, yeah, I think it's a decent effort, pretty well done.
Fantastic. Thanks, Robin. Have fun in Cannes.
Cheers, mate.
Ian, why don't agencies advertise themselves more often? You know, they spend their whole time arguing to clients, advertising works until it comes to themselves.
Well, I think, you know, if you think of not just advertising but marketing, I think, you know, we do a lot to promote ourselves in the broader marketing area, and some do that better than others. So we do definitely market ourselves. When it comes to actual advertising, it's working out where you're going to get the best return on investment, to go back to the start of the conversation.
Colin likes you to send him a YouTube link.
and often the
I'm
the,
very
the,
savvy.
The best way to do that is through, you know, you talked about EDM. But, you know, just general, direct marketing, response marketing, relationship marketing is probably been the most successful for agencies over a given number of years. And so we tend to go back to that form of communication. I like the idea of Sphere advertising themselves. I think it's a great idea. I think they should, you know, I think we should be doing more of that sort of thing. The reality is it costs an awful lot of money, and the audience that we're speaking to is fairly small and narrow, so there's only X number of people that you really need to reach. So there's an awful lot of production that goes into reaching a fairly small number of people.
Next, Bingle.
Tuesday night saw the arrival of Ten's new personality-led, and I use that term advisedly, reality show, Being Laura Bingle. Airing at 8 p.m, it averaged just the wrong side of a million viewers at 925,000. Colin, you broke it down. Can you please explain?
Sure thing. So it was originally scheduled for 8 p.m, but it went out at 8:11, just after a MasterChef that had Jamie Oliver on it. So that was always going to bring in a good crowd. It peaked at 1.2 million, but that was in its first minute. So I'm guessing MasterChef just ran straight into, or Bingle ran straight after MasterChef. But it fell away quickly. Its lowest number was 616,000, and it returned to about 1 million at 8:32 when Bikey Wars was scheduled to start. Maybe a bit deceptive. These are the games we're seeing the networks play in scheduling. Overall, it placed 13th and did okay in the 16 to 39 and 18 to 49 demos, placing 6th. And interestingly, despite it being set in Bondi, it rated higher in Melbourne than Sydney. Tim, you caught it. I believe you said it wasn't as bad as you expected.
Yeah, I mean, for what it was, it was very well put together. I'm not sure how they're going to give themselves much room to go anywhere from here, though, because I think the main sort of headline moments of the last few months in the tabloids of Bingo were her being not that great, being stopped by the cops for not having a license or not having the correct license, and being not understanding how glass worked, and being photographed naked through the window of her apartment. She didn't realise if she could see out, they could see in. So I'm not sure how they're going to be able to build it up from there, but it was very nicely edited together. It went quite fast. It was good confectionery. You know, I was following what people were saying on Twitter, and they, you know, people didn't seem to be hating it. There was actually less volume of tweets than I expected. Actually, you know, I thought there would be more being said about it, but I went in feeling quite cynical. But actually, I would say that night's telly was a good night's telly on 10. It sort of went from MasterChef was a pretty good episode into Bingo, and then first time in a few weeks I've been tuning in for Bikey Wars, and they're finally getting around to the massacre now. So
not all Callan Mulvey looking dreamy and on his motorbike.
Well, more just the you know, they were getting the guns and the baseball bats out now, so that was what was doing it for me.
Awesome. I enjoyed always a favourite, Ad Grunt, one of our serial commenters. And he said, being Lara Bingle, the answer to a question no one was asking.
And, Pez, did you actually happen across Channel 10 on the night of being Lara Bingle?
I didn't see the show, but I think it's interesting commentary in terms of, you know, how it's performed, because I think, you know, people are very quick to bag 10 at the moment and say it's the wrong sort of thing to be doing. I kind of got a different view, which is, you know, the problems that Channel 10 have had have been not about having a defined positioning, and they're now trying to move back to a defined positioning around younger, more interesting, different types of shows. And
all
I think,
Shire all the time.
Yeah, all Shire all the time. And I think Lara Bingle is probably one of those examples, and whether it's the sort of show I would watch or not is actually irrelevant. I think what's interesting is they've tried to be a little bit more focused in terms of what they're delivering, and certainly you can't ever expect a show like that to deliver numbers way over $1 million. So a million people. But I think... you know, I think it's actually done quite well for first up, but I think you're right, it'll be very difficult to see how it'll sustain that audience over time. But if it can sustain close to those numbers, I actually think it'll be a success.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I was interested in sort of breaking it down is because we're used to this as a format coming in from the US, but how do we like our celebrities or our, you know, personalities, our own personalities in such a format? I mean, as you mentioned, Tim, we're going to see it with the Shire. Wag Nation is going out on Foxtel, which is like Australian footballers' wives.
Puberty Blues, also set in the Shire.
True. A drama, though, so slightly different. I'm just more about these sort of
I'm more
trashy...
about the Shire.
Okay.
Have you ever been to the Shire?
No, it's more a mythical place. It sounds like something from The Hobbit.
I popped onto Lara's Twitter account just sort of to see what had been said and what she was saying, and like it must have been,
that doesn't count as stalking.
No, and it must have been about a minute before it was going to air. She tweeted, "Shitting myself," and then
and unfortunately, then, she wasn't talking about the show.
No, and then yesterday she said, it was in the afternoon, and she tweeted, "Just finished shooting. Off for a swim and a sauna." And I thought...
That is stalk bait.
I thought for the market that this show is going out to, she's a pretty girl. Shouldn't that stuff be in the shoot? Isn't that sort of the young boy? No? Am I wrong?
Not the target audience, I don't think.
Okay.
Elsewhere in TV land, the second game of The State of Origin played on Wednesday night, rating just under 2.5 million.
Which was a pretty decent result, pretty much up there with round one as well. Pez, what are your viewing habits? Are you a sport watcher on TV?
I do tend to watch an awful lot of sport. I watch a little bit of drama as well. I've become an Offspring fan, which probably not something you'd peg me for, but the missus started watching that, and I think it's a fantastic example of some, you know, really good Australian content that has done well. Maybe it's been promoted better than some of the films. But, you know, I really enjoy that. I watch an awful lot of... my other favourite show is QI with Stephen Fry, who I just sort of become addicted to and enjoy that. But, you know... Watch as much as I can, mostly IQ'd, but yeah.
And I think it's the first time that the word IQ has been used in the same paragraph as Lara Bingham as well. That is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Ian.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
To Kathy.
Thank you.
And to Colin.
Thanks, Tim.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded noisily in the studios of CBS Interactive. The music you hear is from Noise International. See you next week. Toodle pip. That is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Ian.
Sure.
Do that one again.
A little more pizzazz this time.
Hang on.